Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He answers him from his heavenly sanctuary with the victorious power of his right hand. Psalm 20:6. You've probably heard of Hanukkah. 8 nights, 8 candles, spinning dreidels, gifts exchanged, families gathered around menorahs glowing in winter windows. But have you ever stopped to ask why? Why 8 days? Why the lights? Why does this holiday even exist? The answer involves a story that most people have never heard. A story of rebellion, faith, and impossible victories. A story that begins with the end of everything the Jewish people held sacred, and ends with the birth of a festival that still burns bright 22 centuries later. This is the story of the Maccabees. And to understand who they were, we need to go back to a time when the Jewish people faced not just conquest, but complete erasure. When their God, their laws, their identity, everything that made them who they were was marked for extinction by the most powerful empire in their world. Let's start at the very beginning. For most of history, being a small nation caught between great empires was a death sentence. The Jewish people knew this better than anyone. Their kingdom had been destroyed centuries earlier. In 586 BC, the Babylonians had conquered Jerusalem, burned Solomon's temple to the ground, and dragged the Jewish people into exile. 70 years later, when the Persian Empire defeated Babylon, the Jews were finally allowed to return home and rebuild their temple. But they never truly regained their independence. For the next few centuries, the land of Judea was passed from one empire to another like a piece of property. The Persians controlled it. Then came a young Macedonian king who would change the world forever. His name was Alexander the Great. In just 13 years, from 336 to 323 BC, Alexander conquered most of the known world. He swept through Greece, Persia, Egypt, and pushed all the way to India. But Alexander wasn't just building an empire through military conquest. He had a vision, a dream, of uniting the world under Greek culture. This vision had a name, Hellenism. Hellenism was more than just speaking Greek or wearing Greek clothes. It was an entire worldview. Greek philosophy, Greek athletics, Greek art and theater, Greek religion with its pantheon of gods, Greek gymnasiums where men exercised naked, Greek values that emphasized human achievement, physical beauty, and rational thought. To be clear, Greek culture produced incredible achievements: democracy, philosophy, mathematics, drama, architecture. But it also came with baggage that directly contradicted Jewish beliefs. The Greeks celebrated the human body. The Jews valued modesty. The Greeks worshipped many gods. The Jews worshipped one. The Greeks valued blending cultures together. The Jews valued remaining distinct as God's chosen people. When Alexander the Great marched through Judea in 332 BC, the Jews submitted without a fight. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, Alexander even visited Jerusalem and paid respect to the Jewish high priest. Whether or not that story is true, we know Alexander left the Jews relatively undisturbed. They could keep their temple, practice their religion, and follow their ancestral laws. But when Alexander died suddenly in 323 BC at just 32 years old, his massive empire imploded. His generals, called the Diadochi, or successors, carved up his conquests and spent the next several decades fighting each other for dominance. Eventually, the empire fractured into several Greek kingdoms, each ruled by one of Alexander's former commanders and their descendants. Two of these kingdoms matter most for our story: the Ptolemaic Kingdom in Egypt, and the Seleucid Empire in Syria. And Judea? It sat right between them. Imagine living in a small country, positioned between two superpowers, constantly at war with each other. That was life for the Jews. For about a century after Alexander's death, Judea was controlled by the Ptolemies in Egypt. This period was relatively peaceful. The Ptolemies allowed the Jews significant autonomy. The temple functioned, priests officiated, sacrifices were offered, the Torah was studied and followed. Life went on. But the Seleucids in Syria never stopped wanting Judea for themselves. In 200 BC, they finally got their chance. At the Battle of Panium, the Seleucid king Antiochus III defeated the Ptolemaic forces and seized control of Judea. At first, this seemed like it might even be an improvement. Antiochus III issued decrees protecting Jewish religious practices. He even provided funds from the royal treasury to support the temple sacrifices. The Jews had reason to hope that life would continue, much as it had under the Ptolemies. That hope was short-lived. When Antiochus III died in 187 BC, his son Seleucus IV took the throne. And when Seleucus IV was assassinated in 175 BC, his brother seized power. This man would call himself Antiochus IV Epiphanes. That name, Epiphanes, is crucial to understanding what happened next. It means God manifest. Antiochus IV genuinely believed he was the earthly manifestation of the Greek god Zeus. He put his face on coins alongside images of Zeus. He demanded worship as a living god. This wasn't just arrogance. This was a man with a dangerously inflated sense of his own divinity. And when someone believes they're a god, they don't take kindly to anyone who refuses to acknowledge it. Antiochus IV had another problem beyond his ego. He was broke. His military campaigns had drained the treasury. His wars against Egypt had been expensive. And Rome, the rising power in the West, was increasingly limiting what he could do militarily. The Romans had humiliated him during his Egyptian campaign, literally drawing a circle around him in the sand and demanding he agree to withdraw before stepping out of it. For a man who called himself God manifest, the humiliation was unbearable. So Antiochus needed money. Lots of it. And when he looked around his empire for sources of wealth, his eyes fell on Jerusalem. The Jerusalem temple wasn't just a place of worship. It was also a treasury. For centuries, Jews from all over the world had sent contributions to the temple. Gold and silver accumulated there. Sacred vessels made of precious metals filled its chambers. To Antiochus, this looked less like a holy site and more like a bank vault he could plunder. But there was a problem. He couldn't just march into Jerusalem and rob the temple without cause. He needed an excuse. Better yet, he needed someone on the inside. That's where the real tragedy begins, not with a foreign invader, but with betrayal from within. Let's talk about the office of high priest. In Jewish tradition, this was the most sacred position in the religion. The high priest was descended from Aaron, the brother of Moses, whom God himself had appointed. Only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber of the temple where God's presence dwelled, and only once a year on the Day of Atonement. The position was hereditary. It passed from father to son through the priestly line. It wasn't supposed to be something you could buy or sell. It was ordained by God. But by the time Antiochus IV came to power, the office had already become corrupted by politics and wealth. The current high priest was a man named Onias III, a traditionalist who resisted the creeping influence of Greek culture in Jerusalem. He believed in keeping the Jewish people separate and distinct, faithful to their covenant with God. Not everyone agreed with him. Onias III had a brother named Jason, and Jason had ambitions. Jason looked around and saw how Greek culture was spreading throughout the Seleucid Empire. He saw how other cities were adopting Greek customs and reaping economic benefits. He saw opportunity. So Jason went to Antiochus IV with an offer the king couldn't refuse, a massive bribe. In exchange for the money, Jason wanted Antiochus to remove Onias III and appoint him as high priest instead. The sacred office that God had established through Moses was being sold to the highest bidder. A brother was betraying his own brother for political power. And a Greek king who worshipped Zeus was deciding who would serve as high priest in the temple of the God of Israel. Antiochus accepted Jason's bribe. Onias III was deposed. Jason became high priest in 175 BC. But Jason wasn't just buying a religious title. He had plans. Big plans. Plans that would fundamentally transform Jewish society in Jerusalem. Jason was a Hellenizer. This was the term for Jews who enthusiastically embraced Greek culture. Jason didn't just want to adopt a few Greek customs. He wanted to remake Jerusalem into a Greek city. He built a gymnasium right in Jerusalem, near the temple itself. Now, to modern ears, a gymnasium sounds harmless. We think of a place to exercise, lift weights, maybe play basketball. But Greek gymnasiums were something very different. They were centers of Greek culture, where young men gathered to train, exercise, and socialize completely naked. This was standard in Greek culture. Athletic competitions were performed nude. The word gymnasium comes from the Greek word gymnos, meaning naked. The Greeks celebrated the human body and saw no shame in public nudity. But for Jews, this violated everything they believed about modesty. The Torah commanded modesty in dress and behavior. Public nudity was shameful. Yet now, young Jewish men were exercising naked in a building constructed by the high priest himself. It got worse. Circumcision, the physical sign of the covenant between God and Abraham, was visible when naked. Some young Jewish men were so ashamed of this mark that they underwent painful surgical procedures to reverse their circumcisions. They were literally cutting away the physical sign of their covenant with God because they were embarrassed by it in the Greek gymnasium. Torah study declined. Greek philosophy was taught instead. Jewish festivals were neglected while Greek athletic competitions were celebrated. Young men who should have been studying scripture were instead training for Greek-style games. The high priest himself, the man who was supposed to safeguard Jewish tradition, was leading the charge toward Hellenization. But even this wasn't enough for Antiochus. A few years into Jason's tenure as high priest, another man came to Antiochus with an even larger bribe. His name was Menelaus. Unlike Jason, who was at least from a priestly family, Menelaus wasn't even from the tribe of Levi. He had no legitimate claim to the priesthood whatsoever. Antiochus didn't care. Menelaus's bribe was bigger. In 171 BC, Jason was ousted and Menelaus became high priest. Think about what this meant. The position established by God, passed down through Aaron's descendants for over 1,000 years, was now held by someone who had simply paid the most money. It would be like the Pope being chosen not by cardinals, but by whoever could write the biggest check. The sacred had become transactional. Menelaus quickly proved to be even more corrupt than Jason. To pay off his massive bribe to Antiochus, Menelaus began stealing sacred vessels from the temple treasury and selling them. Golden cups and bowls dedicated to God's service were being hawked to Gentiles for cash. When Onias III, the legitimate high priest living in exile, publicly condemned this sacrilege, Menelaus had him murdered. The blood of God's anointed high priest cried out from the ground. The Jewish people were outraged. But what could they do? They had no power. They were subjects of the Seleucid Empire. Their temple was being robbed. Their priesthood was being bought and sold. Their identity was being erased. And it was all being done with the approval, even the participation of their own leaders. Then everything exploded. In 169 BC, Antiochus IV invaded Egypt. He wanted to conquer the Ptolemaic kingdom and unite the two great Hellenistic empires under his rule. While he was away fighting in Egypt, a rumor spread through Jerusalem. Antiochus had been killed in battle. Jason, the former high priest who had been ousted by Menelaus, saw his opportunity. If Antiochus was dead, maybe he could reclaim his position. Jason gathered an army of about 1,000 men, attacked Jerusalem, and drove out Menelaus. He slaughtered thousands of fellow Jews who had supported Menelaus and the Hellenizers. Blood ran in the streets of the holy city. Civil war erupted. But there was one problem with Jason's plan. Antiochus wasn't dead. When news reached Antiochus that Jerusalem had revolted, that his appointed high priest had been driven out, that Jews were killing each other in civil war, he was apoplectic with rage. How dare these Jews rebel against him? How dare they reject the Greek culture he was so graciously offering them? Antiochus turned his entire army around and marched on Jerusalem with the fury of a god-king scorned. What happened next was one of the darkest moments in Jewish history. The Jewish historian Josephus records that 40,000 Jews were killed in just 3 days. Another 40,000 were sold into slavery. Jerusalem ran red with blood. But Antiochus wasn't satisfied with just military conquest. He wanted to send a message. He wanted to break the Jewish spirit once and for all. Antiochus personally entered the Jerusalem temple. This was already a profound violation. Only the high priest was permitted to enter the inner sanctuary, and only on the Day of Atonement. But Antiochus walked right in. He ransacked the treasury, taking 1,800 talents of gold and silver, an enormous fortune. Then he did something that shocked the ancient world. He desecrated the altar. The altar of burnt offering was the heart of temple worship. It was where priests offered daily sacrifices to God on behalf of the people. It was sacred, consecrated, holy. Antiochus took a pig, an animal the Torah explicitly calls unclean and forbidden, slaughtered it on the altar, and sprinkled its blood throughout the temple. He was deliberately defiling the most sacred space in Judaism, mocking the God of Israel by offering him the most unclean sacrifice imaginable. But Antiochus still wasn't finished. He issued a series of decrees that went beyond mere conquest. These weren't laws designed to control a population. They were laws designed to erase an identity. The Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible, the foundation of Jewish law and identity, was banned. Possessing a scroll of scripture became a capital offense punishable by death. Circumcision was forbidden. The physical sign of the covenant between God and Abraham, the practice that had defined Jewish identity for nearly 2,000 years, was now illegal. Sabbath observance was outlawed. The weekly day of rest that God himself had commanded, the day that reminded Jews of their Creator and their covenant illegal. Jews were forced to sacrifice pigs to Greek gods. They were compelled to eat pork. Altars to Zeus and other Greek deities were erected in every Jewish town. And anyone who refused? Death. This wasn't taxation. This wasn't political control. This wasn't even religious persecution in the conventional sense. This was cultural genocide. This was an attempt to extinguish the Jewish people as a distinct entity, to erase their covenant with God from history, and to make them forget who they were. The persecution was systematic, brutal, and horrifying. Mothers who circumcised their infant sons were executed. Their babies hung around their necks as they were paraded through the streets before being thrown from the city walls. Families found with Torah scrolls were burned alive along with the sacred texts. A group of about 1,000 Jews who had fled to caves to observe the Sabbath in secret was discovered by Greek soldiers. The soldiers attacked on the Sabbath, knowing the Jews would refuse to fight on the holy day. The faithful Jews did exactly that. They refused to defend themselves, choosing to die rather than violate God's commandment to rest on the Sabbath. Men, women, and children were slaughtered. Not one survived. Jewish identity was being systematically destroyed. The message from Antiochus IV Epiphanes couldn't have been clearer. Renounce your God, abandon your traditions, and become Greek or die. For many Jews, the choice seemed impossible. How could they survive? Resistance meant death. Compliance meant losing everything that made them who they were. The God of their ancestors seemed silent. The temple was defiled. The priesthood was corrupt. Foreign armies occupied their land. Greek culture surrounded them on every side. What could anyone do against an empire? That's when an old priest in a small village decided he'd rather die than bow. The village was called Modin. It sat in the hill country about 17 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Nothing particularly special about it. A small farming community where everyone knew everyone else. Where life moved at the pace of planting and harvest. Where faith was simple and traditions ran deep. The village priest was an elderly man named Mattathias. He belonged to the priestly order of Jorib, meaning he was a legitimate priest from the tribe of Levi, descended from Aaron himself. He had 5 sons, John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan. They were a faithful family, keepers of the covenant, in a time when keeping the covenant could cost you everything. When Antiochus's officers arrived in Modin to enforce the king's decrees, they gathered the townspeople in the village square. Their mission was clear. Force the Jews to sacrifice to Greek gods. Break them. Make them comply. The officers approached Mattathias first. This made strategic sense. He was the town's priest, its religious leader. If he complied, others would follow. If the shepherd submitted, the flock would too. They offered him a deal. Sacrifice to the Greek gods, they said, just this once. Just as a gesture of loyalty to the king. In return, they promised him silver and gold. They promised him the king's friendship and favor. They promised him safety for himself and his family. All he had to do was betray everything he believed. Mattathias looked at these foreign officers. He looked at the pagan altar they had erected in his village. He looked at his 5 sons standing beside him. And he made his choice. His words rang out across the village square, and they would echo through history. Even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him, and have chosen to obey his commandments, every one of them abandoning the religion of their ancestors, I and my sons and my brothers will continue to live by the covenant of our ancestors. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion, to the right hand or to the left. It was a line in the sand, a declaration of defiance. An old priest telling the most powerful empire in his world, no, not today, not ever. The king's officers weren't impressed by speeches. They had quotas to meet, orders to follow. But before they could respond, something unexpected happened. Another Jewish man from Modin stepped forward. Maybe he was afraid. Maybe he had been seduced by promises of reward. Maybe he simply saw no point in dying for ancient traditions that seemed increasingly irrelevant in the Greek world. Whatever his motivation, he approached the pagan altar, ready to offer the sacrifice that Mattathias had refused. Mattathias watched this Jewish man, his neighbor, someone he had known for years, walked toward the altar. He saw a fellow Jew about to betray the covenant, about to participate in idol worship, about to help Antiochus erase Jewish identity. And something inside the old priest snapped. The Bible describes what happened next in stark, unflinching terms. Mattathias was filled with zeal. He killed the Jewish apostate right there at the altar. Then he turned and killed the king's officer who was enforcing the decree. Then he and his 5 sons physically tore down the pagan altar with their bare hands. In the stunned silence that followed, Mattathias cried out to the crowd, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me!" Then he and his sons ran. They fled to the hills, to the wilderness, to the caves that dotted the Judean countryside. It was either the bravest or the most foolish thing imaginable. An elderly priest and his 5 sons had just murdered representatives of the Seleucid Empire and destroyed royal property. They had declared war on one of the most powerful kingdoms in the world. They had no army, no weapons, no training, no resources, just faith, fury, and an absolute refusal to abandon the god of their fathers. But word of what happened in Modin spread like wildfire through Judea. Other faithful Jews, those who would rather die than abandon the covenant, began joining Mattathias in the wilderness. These were the Hasidim, the pious ones, Jews who had remained faithful to the Torah even when it became illegal. They were farmers, shepherds, craftsmen, merchants, ordinary people who had reached their breaking point. They formed a resistance movement, hiding in caves during the day and striking at night. They attacked Greek garrisons. They assassinated Jewish collaborators who were enforcing Antiochus's decrees. They destroyed pagan altars in Jewish villages. They even forcibly circumcised boys whose parents had succumbed to the king's laws. These weren't professional soldiers. They had no military training, no uniforms, no battle formations. They were refugees fighting a guerrilla war from caves and hills against the professional armies of an empire. But they had something the Greek armies didn't have. They were fighting for their God, their families, and their very right to exist as a people. The resistance faced a devastating test early on. Remember that group of about 1,000 Jews who were killed in caves because they refused to fight on the Sabbath? When Mattathias heard about this massacre, he faced an agonizing decision. The Torah commanded rest on the Sabbath. No work, no labor. But did that include defending yourself from murder? The 1,000 Jews in the caves had interpreted the law to mean they couldn't fight back, even to save their lives. They had died for their strict interpretation of Sabbath law. Mattathias gathered his followers and made a ruling that would save the rebellion. If we all do as our kindred have done and refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives and for our ordinances, they will quickly destroy us from the earth. Let us fight against anyone who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our kindred died in their hiding places. They would still observe the Sabbath. They wouldn't initiate attacks on the holy day, but they would defend themselves if attacked. This decision allowed the Jewish resistance to survive. For about a year, Mattathias led the rebellion. But the old priest wasn't young anymore. The stress of living in caves, constantly fleeing from Greek patrols, fighting a guerrilla war against an empire, it took its toll on his aging body. As Mattathias felt his strength failing, he gathered his 5 sons around him for final instructions. His words to them were both practical and prophetic. He told them to listen to their brother Simon, for he is wise in counsel and will always be your advisor. Simon was the strategist, the thinker, the diplomat. But military command should go to Judas. He has been a mighty warrior from his youth. He shall command the army for you and fight the battle against the peoples. Then Mattathias died, passing the torch to the next generation. The old priest who had started it all was gone, but the fire he had lit was just beginning to spread. Leadership of the rebellion passed to his 3rd son. His name was Judas, but history would remember him by his nickname, Maccabeus. The word Maccabeus most likely comes from the Aramaic word makaba, which means hammer. And that's exactly what Judas would become, a hammer that would strike blow after blow against the Seleucid Empire. Some scholars suggest alternative meanings. Maybe it was an acronym from the Hebrew phrase Mikamocha Baelim, YHWH. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? The song Moses sang after God parted the Red Sea. Maybe it simply meant the hammer because of how he struck down his enemies. Either way, the name stuck. Judas Maccabeus, the hammer. And Judas wasn't just taking on the nickname, he was about to live up to it. Judas Maccabeus had no formal military training. He hadn't studied under famous generals. He hadn't attended a military academy. He was the son of a village priest who had learned to fight by necessity, not by training. But Judas had something that military textbooks couldn't teach: brilliant tactical instincts, unshakable faith in God, and an intimate knowledge of the Judean hill country. He knew every pass, every valley, every cave, and every hidden path. He knew where to ambush enemy forces. He knew how to strike and disappear before reinforcements could arrive. Most importantly, Judas understood what this war was really about. This wasn't about territory. This wasn't about tribute or taxes. This wasn't a political dispute that could be solved through negotiation. This was about survival, about identity, about whether the covenant between God and Israel would endure or be extinguished forever. The Seleucid commanders completely underestimated the Jewish rebels. To them, this was a minor uprising of religious fanatics in a backwater province. Send some troops, crush the resistance, and restore order. Standard procedure. They had no idea what was about to hit them. The first major engagement came when Antiochus's general Apollonius marched into Judea with a substantial force. Apollonius was confident, experienced, and commanded well-trained professional soldiers. He expected to crush the rebellion quickly and be back home in time for dinner. Judas had other plans. Using his knowledge of the terrain, Judas ambushed Apollonius's army in the narrow mountain passes where the Greek formations couldn't maneuver effectively. The Greek soldiers, trained for fighting in open fields with organized phalanx formations, found themselves trapped in rocky terrain where their tactical advantages meant nothing. The battle was a massacre, but not of the Jews. Apollonius's forces were decimated. Apollonius himself was killed. Judas took the general's own sword as a trophy and used it in battle for the rest of his life. Every time a Greek soldier saw that sword, they knew the man wielding it had killed one of their generals. The Seleucids were shocked. This wasn't supposed to happen. A ragtag group of Jewish rebels had just destroyed a professional military force and killed its commander. Clearly, Apollonius had been incompetent. Send a better general. They sent Seron, the commander of the Syrian army. Seron marched into Judea with an even larger force, determined to avenge Apollonius and crush the rebellion once and for all. He made sure everyone knew he was coming. He wanted Judas to be afraid. Judas wasn't afraid. When Judas's men saw the size of Seron's army approaching, some of them panicked. One of his soldiers asked, "How can we, few as we are, fight against so great and so strong a multitude?" Judas's response became one of the most famous speeches in Jewish history. "It is easy for many to be hemmed in by few, for in the sight of heaven there is no difference between saving by many or by few. It is not on the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but strength comes from heaven. They come against us in great insolence and lawlessness, to destroy us and our wives and our children, and to despoil us. But we fight for our lives and our laws. He himself will crush them before us. As for you, do not be afraid of them." Then Judas attacked. Once again, using guerrilla tactics and superior knowledge of the terrain, Judas's forces routed Seron's army. Seron himself barely escaped with his life. 800 of his soldiers weren't so lucky. Two major defeats. Two humiliated generals. The Seleucid commanders finally realized they had a serious problem. These weren't just religious fanatics to be easily crushed. This was a legitimate military threat. News of the defeats reached Antiochus IV. The king, who called himself God Manifest, couldn't believe what he was hearing. These primitive Jews were defeating his professional armies? Impossible. Unacceptable. Intolerable. But Antiochus had his own problems. He needed to campaign in the eastern part of his empire, dealing with other rebellions and threats. He couldn't personally lead the campaign in Judea. So, he appointed his chancellor, a nobleman named Lysias, as regent, and gave him a simple order. Crush the Jewish rebellion, whatever it takes. Lysias assembled a massive force. The ancient sources report 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry, though these numbers might be exaggerated. Either way, it was a serious army, not a punitive expedition, but a full military campaign designed to annihilate the Jewish resistance once and for all. Lysias placed the army under the command of three generals, Ptolemy, Nicanor, and Gorgias. These were experienced commanders, not the incompetent generals who had been defeated before. They marched south toward Judea with confidence. The Seleucids were so certain of victory that slave traders followed the army, bringing chains and silver to purchase the Jewish captives they fully expected to take. The going rate was supposedly 80 slaves for one talent of silver. They were already counting their profits before the battle even began. When Judas and his men saw the size of the Greek army encamped at Emmaus, about 20 miles from Jerusalem, many wanted to flee. The odds were impossible. How could their small, poorly equipped force possibly stand against such overwhelming military might? Judas gathered his men and gave another speech that would echo through the centuries. Arm yourselves and be courageous. Be ready early in the morning to fight these Gentiles who have assembled against us to destroy us and our sanctuary. It is better for us to die in battle than to see the misfortunes of our nation and of the sanctuary. But as his will in heaven may be, so shall he do. Then Judas did something brilliant. Instead of attacking the Greek camp head-on, he divided his forces and used darkness as cover. The Greek general Gorgias, thinking he was clever, led a portion of the army out at night to ambush what he thought was the Jewish camp. But when he arrived, he found it empty. Judas had outmaneuvered him. While Gorgias was off searching for Jewish rebels who weren't there, Judas attacked the main Seleucid camp from an unexpected direction. The Greeks, caught completely off guard and with a significant portion of their army away with Gorgias, panicked and fled. When Gorgias returned and saw his camp in flames and his army scattered, he retreated without even engaging. The slave traders never got their merchandise. Instead, Judas's men captured the Greek camp, along with all its supplies, weapons, and the gold and silver the slave traders had brought. What was meant to be used to buy Jewish slaves became spoils of war for the Jewish fighters. Victory after victory followed. Lysias himself led another massive force into Judea the following year, this time approaching from the south through Idumea to avoid the mountain passes where previous Greek armies had been ambushed. At Bethzer, near Hebron, Judas met Lysias in open battle and won. The Seleucid Empire, one of the great powers of the ancient world, heir to Alexander the Great's conquests, controller of vast territories from Asia Minor to Mesopotamia, couldn't defeat a guerrilla army of Jewish rebels led by a village priest's son. The impossible was happening. David was defeating Goliath. The hammer was striking, and the empire was reeling. But for Judas, military victories were never the end goal. They were a means to an end. And that end was the temple. 3 years had passed since Antiochus the IV Epiphanes had desecrated the temple. 3 years since he had slaughtered a pig on the sacred altar and sprinkled its blood throughout the sanctuary. 3 years since he had set up an altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies itself. For 3 years, faithful Jews had not been able to worship in the temple according to their ancestral laws. For 3 years, the daily sacrifices had been replaced by pagan rituals. For 3 years, the heart of Jewish worship had been occupied by foreign gods. Judas was determined to change that. In December of 164 BC, after defeating Lysias, Judas and his forces marched on Jerusalem. Greek soldiers still held the Acra, a fortified citadel overlooking the Temple Mount, but the temple itself was accessible. What Judas found there broke his heart. The sanctuary was desolate. Weeds and wild plants grew between the stones of the courtyards, turning the sacred space into something that looked more like a wilderness. The gates had been burned, their charred remains still standing as monuments to destruction. The priests' chambers were demolished, rubble where buildings had once stood. And the altar of burnt offering, that sacred place where generations of priests had offered sacrifices to God, where Abraham had offered Isaac, where the daily offerings had connected the people to their Creator, was defiled, stained with the blood of pigs and covered with the remnants of pagan sacrifices. Judas's men saw the destruction and wept. They tore their garments, the traditional sign of mourning, and cried out to God. The temple, the physical symbol of God's presence with his people, lay in ruins. But weeping wasn't enough. They had work to do. Judas carefully selected priests to lead the purification of the temple. Not just any priests, there were still collaborators around who had participated in the Hellenization. He chose only priests who had remained faithful to the Torah, men who had never compromised, who had kept the covenant even when it was illegal to do so. These faithful priests set about the enormous task of cleansing and rededicating the temple. It was meticulous, sacred work. Every stone, every surface, every vessel had to be ritually purified according to the laws Moses had given. The defiled altar of burnt offering posed a particular problem. It had been so thoroughly polluted by pagan sacrifices that it couldn't be cleansed. It had to be completely torn down. But what should they do with the stones? These had once been sacred, part of an altar dedicated to God. But now they were defiled, contaminated by idolatry. You couldn't just throw them away like garbage, they had been holy. You couldn't reuse them, they were polluted. The priests made a wise decision. They carefully took apart the altar stone by stone and stored the pieces in a secure location on the Temple Mount. They would wait until a prophet came, a spokesman for God, who could tell them what to do with the defiled but once sacred stones. They refused to presume to make that decision on their own. Then they built a new altar from scratch, using unhewn stones, just as the law of Moses required. They fashioned new sacred vessels to replace those that had been stolen or defiled. They repaired the sanctuary. They prepared fresh incense. Everything was done precisely according to the Torah, restoring the worship of the God of Israel exactly as he had commanded. On the 25th day of the month of Kislev, exactly 3 years to the day after Antiochus had profaned the temple, the priests were finally ready. They kindled the lamps on the golden lampstand, the menorah that stood in the holy place. Light returned to the temple after 3 years of darkness. They offered incense on the golden altar of incense. They placed the showbread on the golden table. Everything was as it should be. Then, in the courtyard, they offered the first burnt offering on the new altar. The fire that consumed the sacrifice was the same fire that had burned on the altar in Solomon's day. The fire that represented God's acceptance of worship, God's presence with his people. The temple was home again. God's house had been reclaimed. The celebration lasted 8 days, mirroring the Feast of Tabernacles, one of the great pilgrimage festivals of ancient Israel. There was singing and music. People played harps and lyres and cymbals. They carried palm branches and sang hymns of thanksgiving. The streets of Jerusalem echoed with joy after 3 years of horror. Judas and his brothers issued a decree. Every year, for 8 days, beginning on the 25th of Kislev, the Jewish people would celebrate this rededication of the temple. They would remember what God had done, how he had delivered them from an empire that tried to erase them, how he had allowed them to restore his house. The Hebrew word for dedication is Hanukkah. And so Hanukkah was born not as a minor festival, but as a celebration of survival, of resistance, of refusing to let go of identity and faith, even when an empire demanded it. The 8 days commemorated the 8 days of that first celebration, the 8 days of joy after 3 years of horror. Later, Jewish tradition would add another layer to the story. According to the Talmud, when the priests went to light the menorah in the temple, they found only one small flask of ritually pure olive oil, enough to burn for just one day. But miraculously, that oil lasted for 8 days, until more pure oil could be prepared. This is why Hanukkah lasts 8 days, and why lighting candles became central to the celebration. Whether or not the miracle of the oil happened exactly that way, the story captures something true. A small amount of light persisting against impossible odds, refusing to be extinguished. That's exactly what the Maccabean revolt was, a small flame of faith that refused to go out, no matter how hard an empire tried to snuff it out. But the story doesn't end with candles and celebration. The war was far from over. Judas and his men had reclaimed the temple, but they hadn't defeated the Seleucid Empire. Greek forces still controlled the fortress in Jerusalem. Greek armies still occupied Judea, and surrounding peoples who had allied with the Greeks began attacking Jewish communities throughout the region. The next several years saw Judas leading campaign after campaign, not wars of conquest, but desperate missions to rescue Jewish communities under attack. In Gilead, east of the Jordan River, local populations were besieging Jewish towns. Judas led a daring rescue mission across the Jordan, defeated the besiegers, and brought the Jewish populations back to the relative safety of Judea. His brother Simon conducted similar operations in Galilee to the north, rescuing Jewish communities and bringing them to Judea. The Maccabees were no longer just rebels, they were protectors of their people scattered across the region. But then came news that changed everything. Antiochus IV Epiphanes was dead. The man who had started it all, the king who called himself God Manifest, who tried to erase Jewish identity, who desecrated the temple and murdered thousands, he died in Persia in 164 BC, far from home. The ancient sources differ on exactly how he died. Some say he was struck with a horrible disease, his body rotting while he still lived. Others say he went mad, tormented by guilt over what he had done to the Jewish people. The second book of Maccabees describes him falling from his chariot and being eaten by worms while still alive, crying out that it was just for him to be subject to God. Whether those details are accurate or embellished, the message was clear. The man who declared himself a god died like any other mortal. The tyrant who tried to destroy God's people was destroyed instead. Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who demanded worship, died alone and in agony. But his death didn't end the war. His 9-year-old son, Antiochus V, took the throne with Lysias, the same general Judas had already defeated as regent. They assembled yet another massive army and marched on Judea. This time, the Greeks weren't underestimating the Jewish rebels. Ancient sources report that Lysias brought 60,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 32 war elephants, enormous beasts that served as ancient tanks, terrifying to anyone who faced them. The Greeks besieged Beth-Zur, then marched on Jerusalem itself. For the first time in the war, the Maccabees found themselves on the defensive. Worse, it was a sabbatical year, according to the Torah. Every seventh year, the fields were supposed to lie fallow, given rest to remain fertile. This meant food supplies were critically low. The Jewish forces and the population of Jerusalem were running out of provisions. The situation looked hopeless. The temple had been reclaimed, but now it seemed like it might be lost again, this time forever. The Greeks surrounded the Temple Mount. Their siege engines battered the walls. Inside, the defenders were starving. Then came an unexpected reprieve, not from God this time, but from Greek politics. News reached Lysias that back in Antioch, a man named Philip was making a play for the throne. Philip had been appointed by the dying Antiochus IV to be regent for his son, but Lysias had seized that role for himself. Now Philip was gathering forces to claim what he believed was rightfully his. Lysias had to make a choice. Continue the siege of Jerusalem and risk losing the Seleucid throne entirely, or make peace with the Jews and rush back to Antioch to secure his position. He chose peace. Lysias offered Judas terms. The Jews could keep the temple and worship according to their ancestral laws. The decrees of Antiochus IV forbidding Judaism would be repealed. The Torah would be legal again. Circumcision, Sabbath observance, dietary laws, all would be permitted. But the Seleucid Empire would still control Judea politically. The Jews would be subjects, paying tribute to the Greek king. For the moment, Judas accepted. The immediate crisis was over. The temple was secure. The law could be observed openly. Jewish identity was no longer illegal. The Maccabean revolt had achieved its primary goal. The Jewish people survived. But the peace was fragile, and everyone knew it. The collaborators who had supported Antiochus's Hellenization program were still around. They still wanted power, They still resented the Maccabees and everything they represented. And they saw an opportunity when yet another new king, Demetrius I, seized the Seleucid throne in a coup. These Hellenizing Jews went to Demetrius with a proposal. They told him that Judas and his followers were troublemakers who would never truly submit to Greek rule. They asked Demetrius to appoint one of them, a man named Alcimus, as high priest. Alcimus wasn't from the legitimate priestly line, but he was willing to cooperate with the Greeks and suppress the traditionalist Jews. Demetrius agreed. Alcimus was appointed high priest, backed by a Greek army led by the general Bacchides. Some of the pious Jews, exhausted by years of war, were willing to give Alcimus a chance. He was at least nominally Jewish, they reasoned. Maybe peace was possible. Alcimus betrayed them immediately. He invited 60 of the pious Jews, probably members of the Hasidim who had supported the Maccabean revolt, to meet with him under a flag of truce. When they arrived, trusting in his word, he had them all arrested and executed in a single day. The treachery reignited the conflict. Any hope of peaceful coexistence with the Hellenizers was gone. It was clear they would never stop trying to destroy the faithful Jews. Demetrius sent another general, Nicanor, with orders to support Alcimus and crush Judas once and for all. Nicanor initially tried diplomacy, but when Judas refused to submit, Nicanor threatened to destroy the temple if Judas wasn't handed over. The priests were horrified. Destroy the temple? Again? After everything the Jewish people had endured to reclaim it? They prayed desperately for God to deliver them. Judas faced Nicanor's forces at a place called Adassa in 161 BC. Once again, despite being outnumbered, the Jewish forces routed the Greek army. Nicanor himself was killed in the battle. When the Greek soldiers saw their general fall, they threw down their weapons and fled in terror. According to tradition, Judas's men cut off Nicanor's head and his right hand, the hand he had raised in arrogance to threaten the temple and displayed them publicly in Jerusalem. The message was clear. Threaten God's house and face God's judgment. The day of Nicanor became an annual celebration. But Judas knew that victories, however impressive, were temporary. The Seleucid Empire wasn't going to give up. Judas made a bold diplomatic move. He sent ambassadors all the way to Rome, the rising power in the Western Mediterranean. Rome was always happy to undermine the Seleucid Empire, one of their main rivals. The Romans agreed to a treaty of friendship with Judas and the Jewish people. On paper, it was a stroke of genius aligning with Rome, gave the Jewish resistance international legitimacy, and threatened the Seleucids with Roman intervention. In practice, Rome was thousands of miles away. They weren't going to send legions to defend Judea. The treaty was more symbolic than practical. When Demetrius learned that Judas had made an alliance with Rome, he was furious. The Roman alliance was a direct challenge to Seleucid authority, an implicit declaration that the Jews didn't recognize Greek sovereignty. Demetrius sent his general Bacchides back to Judea with another enormous army, reportedly 20,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry. Alcimus, the corrupt high priest, came with them. Judas prepared to face them at a place called Elassa. But when his soldiers saw the size of the approaching Greek army, many of them deserted. They had been fighting for years. They were tired. They had families. And the odds this time seemed truly impossible. By the time the battle was about to begin, Judas had only about 800 men left. 800 against 20,000. His officers begged him to retreat. "Let us run away now and save our lives," they urged. "We can come back later with reinforcements." It was the sensible thing to do. The smart military decision. Live to fight another day. But Judas refused. "Far be it from us to do such a thing as to flee from them," he told his men. "If our time has come, let us die bravely for our kindred and leave no cause to question our honor." Judas Maccabeus, the hammer who had shattered so many Seleucid armies, who had defeated generals and reclaimed the temple, who had kept a flame of Jewish faith alive, when an empire tried to extinguish it, he chose to stand and fight. The battle at Elassa in 160 BC was a slaughter. Judas and his 800 men fought with desperate courage, knowing they had no hope of victory, fighting anyway because some things are worth dying for. Judas himself fought in the thick of the battle, his sword, the sword he had taken from the first Greek general he killed, flashing as he cut down enemy soldiers. But there were too many, far too many. Judas Maccabeus fell in battle, surrounded by enemies, fighting to his last breath. When news of Judas's death spread throughout Judea, the people mourned as they had never mourned before. They cried out, "How is the mighty fallen, the savior of Israel?" They buried him in the family tomb at Modi'in, the same village where his father Mattathias had first struck the blow that started everything. The hammer had fallen silent. But the Maccabean revolt didn't die with Judas. It couldn't. Too much had been sacrificed. Too much blood had been spilled. Too much had been won to give up now. Leadership passed to Judas's younger brother, Jonathan. He took command of the resistance forces, and what he lacked in Judas's brilliance on the battlefield, he made up for with political cunning. The Seleucid Empire was tearing itself apart with civil wars. Multiple claimants fought for the throne, each one desperate for allies and legitimacy. Jonathan played them brilliantly, siding with one claimant and then another, extracting concessions each time. Need military support? Grant the Jews more autonomy. Need legitimacy in Judea? Appoint Jonathan as high priest. Need someone to hold territory? Give the Jews control of more cities. Step by step, year by year, Jonathan expanded Jewish control and autonomy. What had started as a guerrilla resistance was beginning to look more and more like an independent state. In 152 BC, one of the rival Seleucid claimants, Alexander Balas, appointed Jonathan as high priest. Yes, Jonathan wasn't from the Zadokite line that had traditionally held the office. Yes, the position was being used as a political bargaining chip, just like in the days before the revolt. But Jonathan was at least a legitimate priest from the tribe of Levi, unlike the corrupt collaborators who had bought the office before. Jonathan ruled as both high priest and military commander for nearly 20 years, continuing to expand Jewish territory and power. He fortified cities, made treaties, and gradually built what was becoming a Jewish state. But in 143 BC, Jonathan was betrayed. A Seleucid general named Tryphon, who was trying to seize the throne for himself, invited Jonathan to a meeting under a flag of truce. When Jonathan arrived with a small escort, Tryphon's forces surrounded him, killed his guards, and took Jonathan prisoner. Tryphon later executed him. The leadership of the family fell to the last surviving son of Mattathias, Simon. Simon was different from his warrior brothers. Where Judas had been the brilliant tactician and Jonathan the shrewd politician, Simon was a statesman and builder. He consolidated what his brothers had won and transformed it into something lasting. In 142 BC, Simon negotiated a treaty with the Seleucid king Demetrius II that granted Judea independence. The Greek garrison finally left Jerusalem after decades of occupation. For the first time in over 400 years since the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem and carried the Jewish people into exile in 586 BC, the Jews were truly free. The people were so grateful that they made Simon's leadership permanent and hereditary. Simon was confirmed as high priest, military commander, and political leader, with the position passing to his descendants. This was the beginning of what historians call the Hasmonean dynasty, named after Hasmon, an ancestor of Mattathias. Simon ruled for 8 years, fortifying cities, strengthening the economy, and building institutions. He minted coins, one of the clearest signs of sovereignty. He built up the port of Joppa. He secured the borders. For the first time in centuries, Judea was stable, prosperous, and independent. But even Simon couldn't escape the violence that had birthed this new kingdom. In 134 BC, Simon was assassinated by his own son-in-law, Ptolemy, at a banquet. Ptolemy hoped to seize power for himself, but Simon's son, John Hyrcanus, survived the assassination plot and took control. John Hyrcanus ruled for 30 years and expanded the Jewish state significantly. He conquered neighboring territories and even forcibly converted some populations to Judaism, a practice that would have horrified his grandfather Mattathias and great-uncle Judas, who had fought precisely for the freedom to practice their faith without coercion. The Hasmonean dynasty would rule for about a century, but it increasingly resembled the very Hellenistic kingdoms the Maccabees had fought against. Later Hasmonean rulers adopted Greek names, fought brutal civil wars over succession, and made alliances with Rome that eventually led to Rome taking direct control of Judea in 63 BC. By the time Jesus of Nazareth was born around 4 BC, Judea was once again under foreign occupation, this time by Rome. The temple still stood, rebuilt and expanded by Herod the Great into one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world. But the high priests were again political appointees chosen by Rome based on who would keep the peace and maintain order. The corruption the Maccabees fought against had returned. The exploitation of faith for political power was back. Foreign armies occupied the land. The cycle had repeated. Yet something fundamental had changed. The Jewish people were still here. Judaism had survived. The Torah was still studied. The temple still functioned. The covenant endured. Because of the Maccabees, there was still a Jewish people for Jesus to be born into. There was still a temple for him to be presented in as an infant. There were still synagogues where he could read scripture and teach. There was still an expectation of a Messiah, an anointed one who would deliver God's people. Think about what almost happened. If Antiochus IV had succeeded in his campaign to erase Jewish identity, if Mattathias had bowed at that pagan altar in Modiin, if Judas and his brothers had given up after the first defeats, if the Jewish people had chosen survival over faith, there might have been no Jewish people left. No covenant. No expectation of a Messiah. No Bethlehem. No manger. No Sermon on the Mount. No cross. No resurrection. The entire story of salvation might have been extinguished in those caves and hills of Judea. But an old priest said no. Five brothers took up the fight. Thousands of faithful Jews chose death over compromise. And God used their faithfulness to preserve his people and advance his plan. That's who the Maccabees were. They were ordinary people, a village priest and his sons, farmers and shepherds, who became warriors out of necessity, who refused to let their identity be erased. They chose to stand firm when standing firm looked like suicide. They fought impossible odds because some things are worth fighting for, even if you lose. And they won. Against an empire. Against overwhelming military might. Against cultural forces that seemed unstoppable. They won because they refused to give up. Refused to compromise. Refused to forget who they were and whose they were. Every year during Hanukkah, when Jewish families light the menorah and add one candle each night until all eight are burning, they're remembering the Maccabees. They're remembering that a small light can push back great darkness. They're remembering that faithfulness matters more than power. They're remembering that God preserves his people. The Maccabean revolt teaches us something profound. Identity matters. Faith matters. Sometimes you have to stand up and say no to the world, even when the world has all the power. Sometimes you have to be willing to lose everything to keep what matters most. Mattathias could have bowed. Judas could have surrendered. Jonathan could have compromised. Simon could have accepted comfortable subjugation. But they didn't. They chose a harder path. A dangerous path. A path that cost some of them their lives. And because of their choice, the light kept burning. The covenant endured. The people survived. The story continued. That's who the Maccabees were. That's what they did. That's why, 22 centuries later, we still remember them. Not because they were perfect, but because they were faithful. Not because they never failed, but because they never quit. The hammer struck. The light endured. And the people of God survived to see another day.